Welcome to the Law Firm Growth Lab, the science of scaling your practice. 3, 2, 1,
action.
Hello, this is Scott Berry,
head of MarketCrest.
I have a very special guest with me today. You guys loved it the first time that we brought him in. It's Jeremy Driver. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, how are you doing, Scott?
Yeah, doing really well. So the first time we brought you in, we were talking about an issue that comes up all the time with clients that we're working with is, you know, is my pricing right? When should I look at it? Should I raise it? And if I'm going to raise it, what are the rules and the thumb, you know, rules of thumb related to that? And man, that was a really great session and something that we got a lot of great feedback on. So today we're going to address something that comes up several times a year for us. We work with clients that are all through their journey from they just started their solo practice to it's maybe a little bit later in life. They built a really nice practice and are thinking about, hey, maybe it's time that I sell because they will probably want me to stay on a little bit, right? And so, you know, how do I go about exploring that? And lucky for us, we have you. You have a lot of experience with that. And that's going to be our topic today, law firm acquisitions.
Awesome.
So thank you. So let's just start off with why should a law firm consider either selling or acquiring?
Well, the selling part is fairly easy. Most people don't want to work until they die. Nothing against that. But if you've built something, a practice that is valuable, then why not monetize that and spend some more time with family, traveling, doing whatever. So there's lots of reasons why people might want to sell and cash out on something that they've built over a number of years. So selling, lots of reasons there. But acquiring, again, most people want to grow their firm.
Yes.
And acquisitions is a great way to grow it if done well and done right. It can actually accelerate and speed up the process of growth over, say, growing organically. And I know you help a lot of firms grow, and that's great, and we definitely want to do that. But acquisitions or any form of acquisitions can accelerate that process even further.
Yep, and get you into markets that you've been wanting to get into.
Yeah. In fact, I've got one client. It's a family law client in Florida, and they're wanting to expand beyond the major metropolitan that they're in because they, for the most part, dominate that market. And so we're now talking about an acquisition strategy that would put them into some of the other major markets in that state. And that's one of the only ways that you can do it other than trying to find somebody, hire them, open an office, and basically recreate the wheel. And you can hit the ground running if you can acquire a firm in another market. So yeah, it can accelerate or fast track growth.
Now, there are some risks associated with acquiring a company. Can you just touch on that a little bit? Because we need to give that some thought. It's not always the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, so my background is actually in mergers and acquisitions, not necessarily with law firms, but my prior to coming into helping law firms grow was mostly in oil and gas and manufacturing. And I did a lot of work with private equity firms. And so there's a lot of mergers and acquisitions in there. And let's just say there's so many ways that things can go wrong. In fact, I have a book on my bookshelf here in my office that is like mergers from hell. So there's so much that can go wrong in there. And that's true for law firms as well. So when law firms, I've had clients who come to me and be like, yeah, I'm looking at doing this. I was like, you do not want to do that. That's going to be a very, very bad thing to do. Number one is overpaying for clients that don't stay or pay. So a traditional sale, as people think of it, I'm going to sell my law firm. And then they'll put a price tag on it and someone pays them that and then they walk away. That's what most people envision with a sale of a business. I would say that with professional service firms, that's normally not how it goes.
Right.
It's not how those sales typically go. It can happen that way if it's a autonomous self-running firm, but those are rare. And so overpaying for clients that don't stay or pay, that's a big one. buying inflated revenue. Again, if you're, when I coach my clients and we're looking to acquire, we only want to pay for what you get. We don't want to pay for what they got in the past. So again, it gets complex, but it'll depend on the particular scenario. But you don't want to pay for goodwill because we're not buying goodwill. We are buying clients and we're buying future revenues. And then the other one is one that's often overlooked, and that's cultural mismatch. If you're getting some people with an acquisition, let's say there's a law firm and the chief lawyer, the owner is retiring, oftentimes they'll have a paralegal or some legal assistants or a secretary or a receptionist that is there and they want them to land softly in the new firm. That can work out great. You've got vetted employees. They know the clients that are coming over. They know the systems. It can be a great thing. But if there's a huge cultural mismatch, I would approach that the same way that I would approach a normal hire. If it's not a good fit for your firm, then you say no. Even if they are highly qualified, even if they are an A player in every respect but your culture fit, then I would say no, they're not a good hire. And the same thing would be as if you're bringing over employees from another firm, you might just have to draw the line and say no, it's not going to work out. Because having a bad employee in your firm, that's a nightmare. So we don't want that. So those are some of them. I mean, we can get into the weeds on a lot of other potential risks, but typically overpaying and really believing, taking for granted what they tell you, and it's like, oh, this is the truth, and not verifying that. A lot of things like that.
And my experience is a lot of times there will be skeletons in the closet and some things that, maybe they weren't running it the way you would run it, or they're not tracking things the way you would track it. They're not handling cash the way you would have handled cash.
And to that point, Scott, this is why most of the, when I'm working with my clients, when I structure an acquisition, we're typically not buying that entity. We're buying that entity's clients because you don't want to buy the skeletons in the closet. You don't want to buy any of their legal liabilities. So we want to avoid that and we want to structure an acquisition that we're buying value. We're not buying an entity because we don't need their entity. We simply need their clients, their client list, and that goodwill that they've built up with those clients. So that's what we're buying. And there's lots of ways we can structure that. I've got good rules of thumb that I work with my clients to do.
So talk about that. As we're talking about buying, how do you like to see the payment terms handled in something like this?
I have what I want to have happen, and then I have what typically happens. I don't like to see my clients pay, and we're talking about acquisitions. I just helped a firm sell their firm. And I will say it was a bit of a unique situation because we were able to help him grow his firm to the point where he had a managing attorney. And that means he could theoretically step back and he doesn't have to work in his firm. Sure, he's still got to be an owner, he's got to do those things. But his firm, for the most part, self-ran. And that made it very attractive for sale. He also had real estate associated with it that he could bundle together, which made it more attractive. And so he was able to find a buyer eventually after we went through some changes. We found a buyer that paid him what he wanted, and they're closing this month. So it worked out really well for him. He got what he wanted. There is a transitionary period. But as far as when I'm coaching my clients to acquire other firms, the rule of thumb is I don't want them paying anything up front if we can help it. Sometimes that's unavoidable because of the other side. They're like, oh, well, we want something. We can structure that in, but it's just like the scales. If we give you more of this, then we're going to give you less of this. And so everything kind of balances out. The way I like to think of the structure is attorneys are very used to this, paying their fee sharing. So they'll pay a bonus or they'll pay a percentage of the fee to another attorney who may have referred the case or anything like that. That's exactly like what we're going to structure the sale. So, from the selling attorney's perspective, I've got all these client relationships. I've got all these clients. I'm going to then make this warm handoff and I'm going to give this recommendation to this new lawyer. Some of them are going to be active cases, but most of them are old clients. And I'm going to tell them to go to you. And any of those clients who end up using you and paying you for services, I'm going to get a piece of that action. That's the value that they're getting. So they're extracting value. The seller is extracting value from the relationships they've built over years. Now, as the buyer, my client, if I'm working with a client and we're acquiring these clients, you only have to pay for revenue you receive. And then you only have to pay the seller when that transaction occurs. So it is a pay for play. And just like any other bonus or commissions, I tell everybody, you should never worry about paying commissions because that's more revenue for you. So that's exactly the way we would structure these. It's like a trailing commission. So if the clients stay and pay, the seller gets rewarded because they told the truth. I've got great clients. They pay really well. Here you go. I'm going to sell it to you. It's very, very valuable. And then if that turns out to be true, everyone wins. The clients get great service from your firm. The seller gets value from that great relationship, which it turned out to be true. And you get higher revenue and you only have to pay a percentage for that. So that's typically the way I like to do it, is no big upfront or no upfront payment. And then we pay out of revenue received from the clients that we receive from that firm. That's a very general outline of the way I like to structure it.
Well, you mentioned transitions, right?
Yes.
So not only is there a transition of ownership, but to a degree, there's a transition of clients as well, right? So clients that their case is still pending, right? And then we all know that in immigration law and in family law, a lot of times you'll get this client back, right? They come back for a second or third time. So how you're managing a successful transition from a client standpoint can be really crucial. Do you have some tips on that?
Yeah, so when we're negotiating a purchase and sale situation, I would demand that the selling law firm, that it be in the contract, that there be a personal and emphatic recommendation. In fact, both sides should negotiate on exactly what that language looks like and what form it'll be sent out, because the seller is going to reach out to all of their past and present clients, and they're going to sell their clients on moving over to this new attorney or law firm. And you want to make sure that it's good, and that it's heartfelt, and that it is strong. It's a strong recommendation. And so that'll be a part of anything that we negotiate. We have to have that recommendation. Otherwise, again, if we've structured the sale right, we don't have to worry about that, because let's say only half the clients come over, you're only paying half the price. You're only having to pay for performance. So if we've structured the deal right, then it's all going to work in your favor. And the seller should be motivated to get all of those clients over so they don't have to perform any more legal services and they still get paid. So all of that works in their favor. Yeah, the seller is going to stick around for some form of transitionary period. And it could be a lot of things. So it depends on, like, if you have a unique marketing perspective, if a unique marketing engine that you're using, if you have a lot of staff and you want to make sure that they all get introduced to the buyer and everybody's onboarded properly and just a smooth handoff and transition. If you've got some really high net worth clients that they're very hands-on, white glove treatment, you might want to stick around so that no one bolts. You don't lose any clients or things like that. There'll be a lot. So I would always, if we're the acquiring, I would always demand that there be some form of transition from the seller and maybe even from some of their staff if we're not acquiring them. And then we would have rules around communication with clients and what that looks like and what that entails and what it doesn't look like. So the key here in any sale that I've worked on is client retention is key to a good deal. Like, we want to keep all the clients and we want them to move to the new firm and we want to keep them in the new firm. So if 80% of the clients stay, both sides win. Now, obviously, we're aiming for 100%. So that's the goal. Not a paper asset. We want those living relationships that continue transitioning from the seller to the buyer, and then the seller helps transition that so that it kind of nurtures it, waters it, and it blooms in the newly planted place.
So, talking about the transitions, should the acquiring law firm give any thought or factor in anything around the transition of the staff and fit and culture, or do you not need to worry about that?
First off, we would have to assess the acquiring firm. So let's say I'm working with a firm. We want to know, do we need any of their staff? That's a really big factor. We might have additional capacity, and this acquisition fills that capacity perfectly. And so we don't need any additional staff. But in some circumstances, the seller, this is like a sticking point for them. Well, I've had this paralegal for 20 years. I need them to land in this new firm, and whatever. So it just is going to depend on the circumstances. But if that staff is there and are needed or wanted, you need to evaluate them exactly like you're onboarding new hires. If they are a good fit, are they qualified? Can they do the job? And then having a good onboarding plan for all of them. You don't want to treat them like it gets a little sticky because they
Afterthought.
know, yeah, they know what they're doing, but you don't want to treat them like they don't know what they're doing, but you also need to treat them like, hey, they're new to your firm.
Yeah,
And
they
so
don't
you
know
want,
you.
they don't know you. They don't know your processes. They don't know your systems. And so you want to give them the respect that they're due because they've been handling these clients and you haven't, but they don't know your firm. So this is probably the area where I see a lot of my clients trip up is onboarding staff. And it also creates the most drama is onboarding the staff. And you know, it's just people. People are always the source of all the drama. And so I think evaluating compatibility in advance, way before we're at the point of onboarding staff, we need to evaluate them, interview them. Hey, is that a good fit? And then be talking to the seller or the owner about whether that's going to be needed and a good fit. And then don't assume that the staff are going to stay with you. Because if they heard about a sale, a really good example is in that sale that I helped negotiate and work with a client on, and he's selling this month. Once the staff found out that they were selling, several of his staff left.
They started looking.
They started looking, yeah, and quietly, and then just up and gave notice, and they were gone. It turned out to be great for him because he was able to replace the staff and then got really good people. And the people that he was able to replace them with, they know that a sale is coming down. So they came in eyes wide open. They know what's going on. And he was even able to upgrade a couple of those positions. So I think somebody leaving your firm usually initially feels devastating, but
Could be an
oftentimes
opportunity.
it's a great thing. It's an opportunity, exactly. And so I think you should make offers, but not promises to those people. So if you find them to be a good fit, think they're going to be an asset to your firm, make them an offer just like you would a candidate who's applied for your job ad. But you can't make promises, even though the seller might want you to.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so, and then you need to onboard them like any new employee. Again, this is the trickiest part is managing the people and the relationships. That's always going to be the trickiest part.
Yeah, and there has to be a good fit. What about what makes a good fit for a law firm? Like, what are you looking for when you start thinking about acquiring? What kind of things are you looking for that would indicate that maybe there's an opportunity here?
I mean, right now we're in a great time because of the baby boomer generation, a lot of attorney baby boomers, and they're approaching that retirement age, if not already at that retirement age. And so I think solo owners nearing retirement, many of them are not advertising their firms. But if you're in networking groups and you recognize someone's of a certain age and they might be, you just judge that they might be considering something like that. Thoughts might be running through their head. I guarantee you will not offend them if you say, "Hey, have you thought about selling your firm?" Because we're in the market and we're definitely acquiring firms and looking to acquire firms. So if you're in the market, love to talk to you. I don't know anyone who would be offended by that. But for whatever reason, a lot of people feel anxious or nervous about broaching that subject, and I don't know why. Most people would be flattered
Oh, yeah, it's a
to have
compliment.
someone. It's a compliment. Like you would want to
Might
consider
be.
acquiring my firm.
Yep.
So I think there's a lot of people quietly considering a sale of their firm, but they've not done anything formal to make the market aware that they're entertaining that idea. So I think networking is a great way, or just cold reach outs to attorneys in your area who you think might be considering that. I don't want to judge people by their age because, look, I've got clients who are well
Done
into their
whatever.
70s and they are practicing, marketing, and growing, and they have no intention of selling anytime soon. So it'll just depend on the person,
Yep.
but no one's going to be offended if you ask them if they want to sell.
Yeah, that's so true. I've had several clients. I'm blessed. They'll come to me and say, "Hey, I'm thinking about selling," or "Hey, I'm thinking about acquiring." And I get a chance to talk to a lot of people about it. And sometimes I'll reach out to my client list and say, "Hey, are you thinking of, are you thinking about it?" And I've never had anybody, be offended. Like they all are like, "Oh, wow, that's yeah, no, I hadn't thought about it, but that's really nice. What do you know?" And we talk. I mean, everyone is, I think, and maybe it's because it's law, they love talking about it. Maybe I will if it's the right fit, or maybe
And
not.
the way I like to think about it is sometimes people's initial reaction is, well, no. And that's not necessarily a no. It's I haven't really thought about it a lot. But you mentioning it is going to plant that seed. And if they have your contact information, your business card, whatever, I guarantee you they're going to be thinking about what you said. Oh, man, what would selling look like? I wonder how much my firm is worth. Maybe I need to call
I don't
so and
mind
so
having
back.
that conversation.
Yeah, let's go to coffee and talk about what that might look like. Another thing to your question is people nearing retirement, I think, is a golden opportunity right now in this market. So I think there's a lot of opportunities in all the markets across the country to do that. But the other one is if you happen to know someone of any age, any point in their career, where they have a good reputation, but maybe they're not the best business owner. Maybe their marketing is just weak, or their systems are weak, or they're not good at finding staff, or
Finance.
just growing in that way and adding people. They're just a true solo and they're trying to handle everything and they're burning themselves out.
Such a great point.
Those are really good candidates. I've had many, and I do not mean to stereotype, but this one particular firm, they're targeting female lawyers who are new mothers. And the reason is because those mothers, that they have their own firms. They're now a new mother with their first child, and they're recognizing, wow, being a mother, running a firm by myself, that might be a little more than I signed up for. And so they'd love to still make great money
And still want to
doing what,
practice.
yes, they still want to practice. But they may not want to have to deal with the headache of running their own firm. So I think those are great opportunities. And they don't have to be, mothers.
Such a
They could just
grand
be
point.
anybody who's like most people work with me because they're great lawyers, but they're not great business owners. And that's great. And that's okay.
It is okay.
I'm not a great attorney. I'm not an attorney at all. I couldn't do what they do. And so we each have our strengths. And so it's just recognizing that that person may want to practice law, but they may not want to run a business anymore. So if you can figure out what their pain points are, maybe it's money, maybe it's time, maybe it's
People and HR stuff.
all of these things, just figuring out what that is, that's actually the area where some of my clients have had the most success, is people who just haven't been good at running their own firm. And then the other one is longtime firms. They have a very loyal client base. I noticed this in smaller markets, not big city markets, but smaller markets where they've got a very loyal client base, but they're under marketed. They're not getting a lot of new clients, but they've got this wonderful loyal client base. But it's not really enough to sustain and have them achieve their goals, and they don't really know how to grow. So, but they've got some pent up value that they wouldn't mind selling and maybe even becoming a part of your firm. So, lots of opportunities there. But I think the retirement age, and I think the people who might not want to run their own firm anymore, those are really good opportunities.
Their passion is more practicing law than worrying about cash,
Yes,
payroll.
100%.
So you mentioned value. How do you determine value? Because I have a feeling that what someone thinks their firm is worth versus what they can get in the real world might be different.
So traditional valuation. And people throw this around if you're on LinkedIn, wherever, in all these business circles, people will throw around, oh, you can get 3x, you can get this. And
Multiples.
Yes, you can get multiples on your revenue or multiples on
Your profit.
your net revenue, your profit, or your EBITDA, or whatever. They'll throw around lots of different stuff, and I'm very familiar with all of it, but they're very industry specific, and professional services is very different.
Yes.
And if we're talking about smaller law firms, I would say sub 2 or 3 million. The owner is typically still heavily involved, and they are the engine that drives that machine. I think the top of the firm, the CEO, whatever, that's always going to be a key position. But an owner in a small law firm is the firm for the most part, with rare exceptions. And so the value is in the owner. It's not always in the firm itself. And so if we get rid of the owner in many ways, we've gotten rid of the bulk of the value. And so that's why we have to structure law firm acquisitions very, very differently. The seller may want, they think they have the goose that lays golden eggs, but we have to evaluate it soberly and say, look, I'm willing to pay for revenue. If your clients are as good as you say they are, I'm willing to give you X percentage of every single one of them that pays. And you'll get that for this period of time and whatever. And that's all down into negotiations and price and everything else. But the value of a firm is going to come down to how many clients, what is the average case value of those clients, and then what is the percentage we're going to be giving to that firm. One of the firms that I just worked with, they didn't acquire another firm. They acquired about 40% of the clients of another firm. And I said, we're going to be very selective about which clients we acquire. And so, like, number one, they have to pay. They have to pay on time. And they, all these various criteria that we had. So that ended up working out well. And sure, as I said earlier, the number one issue that they had, which turned out to be okay, but created the most grief was people. Because they onboarded, I think, three employees from that firm. Turns out to be great, but there was just a lot of drama related to that. And so, in that sale, my client, the purchaser, did pay a little bit up front, and then there was a negotiated price. But that price is paid out over time from fees and revenues collected from the new clients that they acquired, and that's how the price is paid. And so that's not as traditional. I like it just to be a percentage and not have a set price. But this was something that they worked out. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it's against my advice, but it wasn't something that I advised. But it was okay. I think the numbers still worked out and we're still good. But he doesn't ever have to pay, this attorney that is my client, he doesn't have to pay unless he gets revenue. And that was one of the things that we always, it's not billed, it's collected. Because if the clients are billed, we don't care. We can bill all day long, but if you haven't collected the revenue, it doesn't matter. And so we'd have to make sure that that's in the contract is billed and collected. So the revenue has to hit my account before you get anything. And so that's one. If it's a firm that has a lot of repeat business, we're going to value those clients more. We're going to maybe, the percentage might be different. If they're one-off clients, if it's a very one-off kind of firm, then that's very different. Like civil litigation might be one, if especially if you like say you represent if you represent landlords, good, repeat business. But if you represent tenants,
It's a one-time deal.
the one-time deal for the most part. So it we just have to play that by ear and figure out what kind of cases do we have, what's the average case value, how much dollars or how many dollars are we talking about here, how many cases are active, how many clients are coming over, how many old clients do they have, how old are those clients. All of these factor into what we might calculate as the price. And then if it's not producing, this is the rule of thumb, if it's not producing profit into the hands of the buyer, you don't pay anything for it. So there's no value that we're paying for. We only pay for revenue. At least that's the way I work with my clients to structure deals. That's not the way all deals are structured out there. There are a lot of firms that sell for way too much money and people way overpay, and then they're in debt for years just trying to pay off an acquisition that's not giving them any profit. And that's what I try to avoid with my clients is the whole goal of making that acquisition is to gain profit. if you're leveraging everything to do that, then yeah, we're not in any better shape than we were before.
Yeah,
And if
I think you've made it really clear that if you're gonna wildcat this thing and just find somebody and make them an offer and expect that to go well, you don't have the right perspective.
I agree. I
Because
agree.
you're bringing in some points that if any of these points, or let's say two of these points actually happen in a bad way, your whole deal is wrecked.
Oh,
And
yes.
it is easy to buy somebody, and whether it's buying a law firm or another kind of company, and have that purchase fail.
Oh.
Like that happens probably more often than it's successful.
I don't know what the percentages are, but I'm a very risk assessing kind of person, and I've gone through multiple acquisitions and mergers and things like that. And all the things that can go wrong and do go wrong are numerous. The fact that I haven't had as many merger failures and acquisition failures as I could have had, I think it's just dumb luck, honestly, because so many of them do fail, and many of mine came close to failing. So, and then my clients, so many things can go wrong. And so it is not without it is not without risk, but if we structure the deal properly, we mitigate a lot of the worst risk. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, you literally took the word mitigate right out of my mouth. I mean, that's the most you could hope for. And I'm so glad we're introducing you to these people, because I really don't think it's a good idea to move into something like this and make an acquisition without someone to mentor you and guide you through it. It would be a really, really bad decision to do that. So, but let's talk about, so because I actually have a couple of clients, a couple that are looking to sell, and I got a couple that are in acquisition mode. So for those that are in acquisition mode, how do you find the right, like a law, how do you find a law firm to buy?
I mentioned earlier networking. So if you're part of networking groups, just start approaching other firms. Make it known in your network that you're an acquiring law firm. Word will get out, believe me. Word will get out that you're an acquiring, you're on the, nobody's going to be offended by that. Believe me, nobody's going
I'm
to be offended
open
by that.
for acquisition.
Yeah, I'm open for acquisition. I'm looking to acquire other firms if it's a good fit. And then, and you can even make people aware of what you're looking for. I'm looking
And
purely
look,
for,
LinkedIn, like LinkedIn is a great way of
absolutely. Make
communicating.
a post. Just put a post on there. Hey, we're looking to acquire small law firms in the such and such area. And you know, if you're that kind of firm, we'd love to talk to you and make it worth your while. I mean, we want it to be a win-win situation, so it should not be a negative. People being acquired want to be acquired for a reason.
And
But
Facebook groups,
oh yeah.
there's more tools now than there's ever been.
All, we need to leverage all this technology, this thing, this internet and all these tools and social media that supposedly connects us. Let's leverage it. And let's get the word out that you are looking to acquire firms. Strategic referrals. If you have strategic partners, which I emphasize that heavily with all my clients, is you should be networking with lots of other attorneys and other professionals who can give you clients and you can give them clients. Let them all know that you are looking to acquire firms, what type of firms, everything like that, what your criteria are, and then just make your generally just make your intent known publicly. Many owners are quietly looking for an exit.
Great point.
So,
We just got back from the annual convention, the annual conference for AILA, and man, there were 4,000 law firms there and people there. Tons of opportunities to get the word out. Hey, introduce me to anybody that you know here that might be thinking about selling. I'm in acquisition mode. Pass the word.
Yeah, I think it's great. And it will plant a seed in a lot of people's mind who may not have been considering it, and now they're like, "Oh, now that you mentioned that, you know, I've been quietly resenting my own firm, and I'm working too many hours, and you know, yeah, I think a sale of my firm, maybe I can go do something else, you know, either start over or go to work for that firm, or go find a position in another firm, or do something entirely different." It just provides an opportunity. There's lots of reasons people might want to sell. So just get the word out there.
Now,
That's my
once you
advice.
start having this conversation, it's customary to do some due diligence, right? And very quickly it's going to come up, letter of intent,
Yes.
non-disclosure. Just talk about that part of the process.
So, I don't shy away from, I mean, these are attorneys, so they should not be shying away from contracts. But it still surprises me how often people don't want to, like, they don't want to broach that topic. I'm like, you're an attorney. This should be like second nature to want to get this in writing. But, and it also depends upon their practice area. So if, let's say I'm talking to an immigration attorney, they may not be very familiar with business law. And so that's just not an area of expertise for them. And so we just have a standard procedure that we go through. It's typically going to be, let's just talk. We're just talk. Get a meeting of the minds of, hey, are you wanting to sell in a manner that I'm wanting to buy? Just kind of very general. This might be over coffee, it might be over Zoom, what have you. Are we going to gel in this transition? Or are we going to be, is this going to be acrimonious in some way? Do I see friction in the future? If everything looks good, then we can move to an LOI. An LOI is a non-binding agreement that just articulates what we've talked about and has a
That's a
bit
letter
more.
of intent, right?
That's a letter of intent. Yes, letter of intent, LOI. It's typically non-binding. So you can't go and enforce it and be like, they didn't buy my law firm or vice versa. It's just a meeting of the minds and it just provides intent. It's the document that leads to a purchase and sale agreement. So it has the kind of general terms. It can be as short as one page. I've seen LOIs that are dozens of pages. And then I'm a big fan of a one or two page LOI. Because it's non-binding, you don't need lots of boilerplate, CYA language. You don't need that. You just need to, hey, what did we talk about? What is our intent here? And then any of the major points that we want to make sure are clear. And then if everything looks good there and you've negotiated that and looks great, then we move into the due diligence phase. Anything that a seller or a buyer tells you just want to verify. It has to be verified via documents, and it has to be third-party documents. So if they say our revenues were X, well, then I want to see bank statements with deposits, things like that. And those are much harder to fake. I'm not saying people would, but much harder to fake
Well,
than, faking, say, financial statements. I can put anything into an Excel document or and make a PDF of it. But I can't, it would take a tremendous amount of effort to fake bank statements going back 2 or 3 years and make that look plausible and real, and then have it match my books and match my case management software. So if all of that agrees and then you verified it with a third party, which is the bank, then that's the money one. And that's really the big one. The other one is, this will be a little bit later in the due diligence process, is talking to some of their clients and talking to some of their employees, and just verifying. And we're just wanting to see if yellow red flags go off, and whether we're spotting any BS going on. But if everything's looking good, which in most scenarios it is, we verified all the numbers are accurate, then you just kind of check all the boxes and do the proper due diligence. You could search the internet for everything that we need to do, but the big one is always going to be to verify the revenues, verify the profit, and then talk to their clients and talk to their staff.
Yep. And for those that are thinking about actually selling their firm, right? We're talking about those looking to acquire, but for those looking to sell, I would tell you well in advance, get your financial statements in order, get your banks in order, stop taking cash, all that kind of stuff. No one is going to take your word for it and pay you a healthy amount for your business. You
Not at
can't
all.
say, oh, well, this, I do this in cash and then I do this. Like, get your financial house in order before you expect someone to give you good value for your law firm.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Yes. If it's not verifiable, it's not sellable.
Yes.
Now, if you find a gullible person, great, good on you, but it's unlikely to happen. If somebody's got enough money to go out and do some acquiring, they're probably savvy enough to make sure to check your numbers. And yeah, if you don't have good financials and everything else, you're shooting yourself in the foot. I think you need to wait, get your
Wait.
financial house in order, maybe hire MarketCrest to get your marketing up.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you can position your firm in a relatively short period of time to get a better sale.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I would
Again,
definitely
that
buy that.
also would be a good webinar, like just how do you position it to sell? Because there are certain things, and you've touched on them, that really need to be in place if you want to get maximum value
Oh yes. And
or
if you
develop
want to,
maximum interest.
and if you want to cash out, if you want a cash out sale, if that is your goal, you're like, no, I don't want to get a trickle of money from them over the next year or two. I don't want that. I want to sell for a dollar amount and I want that to happen. Then you're going to need a certain type of firm. You're going to need a firm that doesn't operate with you. It doesn't need you to operate. And if you can build that, both the marketing, the sales, and the execution of
Yeah, the
the law
operations.
practice,
Yep.
you have a sellable firm. As long as your financials are good and your profits are good, you have a very saleable firm.
You've given us a lot of really, really great things to think about. And I hope people that are thinking about taking action either way on this would reach out to you for some consultation. But wrap it up, out of all the things that you better do or make sure you don't do, could you boil it down to like what's the number one mistake that people that are looking to acquire, the number one mistake that they make?
The mistakes that they make is paying for promises, taking the seller's word for it, whether it be goodwill, future cases, potential, or how good the clients are. Don't take any of that at face value because no one's going to badmouth their clients if they're selling. It doesn't mean they're lying to you or even trying to deceive you. They're just wearing rose-colored glasses because they're their clients. So this is why we structure the deal. You don't pay for what you can't verify or control, and you don't pay upfront for it. So tie all payments. Any cash that goes from buyer to seller is only paid for real and tangible value, not what's hoped for, not what's promised, preferably for only revenue, build and collect it. And so that's the way we would structure it. So, and if you're considering growing by acquisition or thinking of selling your firm, structure the deal so both parties are aligned. That's a little bit difficult, especially with the manner in which I like to structure deals. Sometimes sellers don't like it initially, and they have to warm up to the idea of not getting a big cash out sale. And we have to convince them, look, you don't have anything to sell like
Not
that.
that kind of business.
Yeah, it's not that kind of business. So we have to do a little bit of education and then we want to get them aligned. So he's like, hey, do you see how this is valuable to you? And then I've helped several firms do that. And then without the risk of overpaying, taking on debt, and then or walking away empty-handed. Because sometimes, not any of my clients, but they buy something and then they got nothing. As you said, a lemon.
All the time.
Oh,
Yeah,
I
too
would not want to
often.
see that happen.
Yeah, not all the time, but too often.
Yes.
So listen, if you are thinking about growing through acquisition, I want you to talk to our friend Jeremy Driver. People went crazy when he did the session on price increases, and I think this about selling and acquiring is just going to be a really exciting conversation for people. Jeremy, tell everyone how to get a hold of you if they want to ask you a few questions or maybe even help you to get you to help them with
Sure.
their acquisition.
Sure. So our website is Ludra.com, Loodra. I know that's a strange name, but Ludra.com. You could submit contact information there, or you can just email me directly at Jeremy, Jeremy, at Ludra.com, Loodra.
Yeah, you might know Jeremy from our previous webinar, or you might know him from being a fractional CEO at How to Manage a Small Law Firm. This is the kind of guy you want in your corner when you're taking business risk. Jeremy, thanks for joining us. It's a pleasure as always.
No, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, take care.